Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Lately, it seems like the world is falling apart. Things we take for granted, like freedom of the press, consumer protection, labor unions to protect working people, are all under attack. So many friends who call me are depressed, scared, and bewildered, asking, what can we do? I tell them, to understand what's really happening in the United States today, you have to read Democracy in Chains by Nancy McLean, professor at Duke University in North Carolina. Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, is a must-read book. We have with us today the author of Democracy in Chains, Nancy McLean. Nancy McLean, welcome to All Together Now.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Eleanor.
I was so impressed with your book, and I think it's so important. I've been telling, really, everybody I know to read Democracy in Chains. For people who haven't yet read the book, can you kind of briefly describe what it's about?
Sure. Well, it's a sort of a dramatic story that might be surprising to readers, that shows how the leading advocates of what we sometimes call neoliberalism now, or free market fundamentalism, rallied to the state of Virginia when it was using school vouchers to fight the Brown versus Board of Education decision. So that's how I first got into the story. But in the course of doing that research, I learned about a particular individual, which probably none of your listeners have heard of, a man named James McGill Buchanan, who turned out to be the only U.S. Southerner to have won the Nobel Prize in Economic Science, which he did in 1986, who was part of this larger free market project and moved to Virginia in 1956 at the peak of Brown versus Board of the resistance the state was leading to Brown versus Board of Education, and set up this new school of thought, a physical center at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, developed this new school of thought. And to make a long story short, I learned through the course of my research that this was the school of thought that Charles Koch and his network of donors have weaponized in order to make tremendous progress for what had always been, a very marginal minority cause that couldn't get anywhere. It's the Barry Goldwater election. Ronald Reagan failed them. George W. Bush failed this libertarian hard right. But by applying Buchanan's school of thought, they have managed to do some of what you were talking about in your introduction, find a way to decimate labor unions, to undermine protections won by generations of struggle, and so forth. And so my book tells the story of how Buchanan began to develop these ideas in the crucible of resistance to the civil rights movement, and actually to the New Deal and workers' power, too, in Virginia, beginning in the late 1950s, and then tells how he came to know Charles Koch in the 1970s, and then how Koch took these ideas beginning in the 1990s to develop this very sophisticated long game strategy of interrelated plays in order to make progress for a cause that dare not speak its name honestly to the public, because what they want is so radical and so against what the majority of Americans are accustomed to and believe in and support, from Social Security to environmental protection to civil rights enforcement, et cetera, that they have to operate by stealth. So it's something of a shaggy dog story, sometimes scary. Some people have told me it's like a Stephen King novel. I don't know if that's true.
It is. I want to see the movie.
Some drama there. And what is most encouraging to me as an author is hearing from so many readers around the country and actually from other parts of the world who are finding the analysis and the story empowering to them, and like it's helping them, understand what's going on in their world and equipping them to fight more effectively. So that has been just incredibly exciting to me and gratifying.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And when I've talked to some friends about it and kind of just give them a summary of what Democracy in Chains is about, there's this little pause in the end, and at the other end of the phone, and they go, well, I thought there was something like this going on. Now, you know, this makes sense to me. This helps explain what's going on. Now, you mentioned about going to the office of Professor James Buchanan at George Mason University in Virginia, and you were there not long after he died, and you found his papers unsorted and unguarded. It was like no one had gone through them yet to sanitize it. So you were getting kind of right from the horse's mouth kind of these secret papers of what James Buchanan had been working on and his connection to Charles Koch, who, as we know, is the king of the dark money. So describe a little bit what that was like going to the office of James Buchanan and what you found there.
Yeah, it was just surreal to me as a researcher and literally heart-stopping at some moments because I had begun piecing this story together. As I said, I was telling this other story, but Buchanan kept appearing in my peripheral vision, so I wanted to know more about him. And then actually another thing that happened before I got into the archives is I moved to North Carolina in 2010, where this radicalized Republican Party, you know, transformed with Koch money and a man named Art Pope, who was their North Carolina partner, came to power and instantly started this radical transformation of North Carolina, a state that had always been kind of the beacon of progressive hopes in the South, and they started turning it into a competitor with Mississippi and Alabama for which would do less for the people and more to suppress democracy. So as I watched that agenda unfold and I was reading Buchanan's published writings, I realized, oh my God, this is what he's talking about. You know, the things he's advising, you know, in the abstract are what they're doing in the concrete and the particular. But I have to tell you, there was a point where I felt like the character, Claire Danes' character in Homeland, you know, the woman who she's a CIA researcher and she thinks something's going on and she has all these charts and files. And there's a point where you can't tell, is it actually happening or does she really need to get on meds? You know, is she imagining things? And I questioned myself because I thought, this is impossible, what I'm thinking is happening, you know, that one, you know, multi-billionaire would have the audacity to think that he can, you know, remap a society and gather other billionaires and millionaires in order to fund this infrastructure to do these things. And so I really did wonder, you know, whether I was losing it or it was really happening. And so for me, also getting into Buchanan's archive there at George Mason was an extraordinary experience because it was still a hypothesis at that point for me, you know, when I got in there. But I got into this old building that had been his working center, and just everywhere there were filing cabinets. There were filing cabinets under the stairs. There were boxes of materials. Neither he nor his secretary believed in filing, it seemed like, and he had also left many places in a huff because he had such an autocratic personality, and so everything was just chaos. But so I just started going through systematically and found, among other things, these exchanges that showed how Charles Koch had invested his first $10 million in George Mason in 1997, 1998, to set off what we're seeing now in America. And what I found initially was a package from a whistleblower, an anonymous whistleblower, who had sent it to Buchanan, to the university administration, to the chair of the economics departments, and others, saying, do you realize that what is coming out from this center is illegal? Right? These people are using a 501c3 nonprofit charitable and educational institution in order to do nakedly brazen partisan fundraising for this center, you know, in collaboration with the Republican Party and with this donor with an arch political vision. So it was just beautiful, you know, like all these documents all together, and then all the responses that came out afterwards from the institution. I also found documents that confirmed Buchanan's role in Chile under the Pinochet dictatorship in advising them in a constitution that exists and operates to this day to restrict popular power. That's kind of a model of what this network wants to impose on the American Constitution. So it was a research experience like no other that I've had in over, well, I don't know, I guess it's about 35 years now or something of doing archival research, and I had never had an experience like this. just
yeah,
amazing.
That's really extraordinary, and I do think it will make a great movie. I hope someone listening or elsewhere decides to make a movie out of this, because it's just so amazing, and how great that even though it's so bold and just so like almost unbelievable that this extremist right-wing billionaire Charles Koch would want to reshape society and have a plan for doing it, and he's really like 30 years down the track now implementing the plans, but you went to the heart of it. You were in the office of James Buchanan, who was one of the key architects that really helped to give the framework and design and strategy for Charles Koch to do what he wants to do. It's a good thing you moved to North Carolina, because you saw in living action that plan in motion, and that this was not some dusty plan stuck in a bin somewhere. This is really the operating plan for Charles Koch and the Koch donor network of what they plan to do in reshaping America. So,
and it is, I just want to add, too, it's really a revolutionary vision. And Buchanan was clear about that. And when Charles Koch was honest in the 1970s, he was clear, too. You know, Charles Koch in particular was contemptuous of conservatives in the 1970s when he set up the Cato Institute. Buchanan always said he was not a conservative. And he said that what we needed was a constitutional revolution in America in order to achieve this libertarian cause's goal. So they were self-consciously radical. And one of the things that also moves me in trying to bring this story to people around the country is that they're being so dishonest with the people whose votes they're depending on, you know, because they've realized they need the votes of conservatives, of, you know, particularly religious conservatives, to move their project down the field. But they were actually, in the old days, you know, Buchanan was contemptuous of people of faith. Charles Koch, you know, Ayn Rand was the hero of the libertarians, who's one of the most anti-clerical, vitriolically anti-religious writers there is, and yet they are using these voters without informing them that they are, in fact, planning to do things like privatize Social Security, privatize Medicare, privatize education, and so forth. So I think it's really important that people get the truth and that these guys are no longer able to mask what they're doing and just put out these bromides about liberty and limited government, but instead be challenged on the real particulars of what their vision means for Americans.
I think
and
that's
people
so
around
right.
the world, by and, the way, too, because it's an international cause.
It is totally international. And let's stay a little bit more here in the United States, and then I want to talk and come back to this situation in Chile that you mentioned. But here in the United States, for people who are not aware of what this radical vision, because, you know, some of our listeners are revolutionary, too, but we want to do it to have a society for, you know, peace and justice and opportunity for all people to thrive and get a good education and good health care.
And be honest with the people that you're trying to move and whose power you want to build. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Well, so we want that. But you're talking about a completely opposite kind of revolution. This is a revolution of the 1%, you know, by and for the top 1%. Describe a little bit more kind of what is their vision when Charles Koch, who is, you know, the king of dark money and behind all of this, really, and he's brought a lot of millionaires and billionaires into his Koch donor network, but he's really the prime mover here. Describe what the vision is. Like, if he gets everything he wants, what can we expect in the United States? What does that look like?
Right. So if he were to tell you what he wants, he would say he wants a world of liberty and of limited government, and that this is going to bring unheard of prosperity and so forth. Now, he doesn't say prosperity for whom, and that's really important. to just begin with to provide orientation, because this whole set of ideas was new to me when I did this research, too. And frankly, we wouldn't be talking about it but for the money, because it's so unpersuasive to the overwhelming majority of people. You know, maybe 2% to 4%, depending on the poll, supports these ideas. But otherwise, they're totally marginal. Nobody would want them. But because of the money that's been invested and the infrastructure that's been built and the cadre they've trained, they have made the headway they have. So they believe that government has only three legitimate functions. Government should enforce the rule of law, provide for the national defense, and ensure social order. So as one interviewer put it to me, that means they believe in courts, armies, and police. Beyond that, they don't think government has any role. So if you think about that, this is actually a revolution not just against 20th century government, although it's particularly that. This is actually a revolution against the whole American way, like since the beginning, because always we had, you know, local and state governments who were doing various kinds of charitable provision, who were, you know, doing things like creating public schools, paving roads, engaging in corporate regulation. These guys want to say that they have the founders' vision, but that is utterly absurd. They have this radical right vision that, again, says only government should only be, you know, courts, armies, and police, if you want to think about it in those terms. And so they believe we should not have social insurance, so no Social Security or Medicare. We should have no health care. They were dead set against preventing the Affordable Care Act and have just actually issued a very misleading, absurd report about Medicare for All that has been skewered by some economists, rightfully, in the press. But anyway, so they believe that we should have, instead of any of these social no public schools, only private schools, unregulated, believe, therefore, that we should all have these individual savings accounts for our various needs. And where would those savings be invested? Well, of course, they'd be invested with the financial sector, right? The corporate financial sector with an unregulated Wall Street would hold all of our life savings. Now, we've seen this movie before, right? 2008 was an example of these ideas in action. And it was, in fact, one of their allied legislators, Phil Graham, in the Senate, who pushed for the financial deregulation that brought us the crisis and crash of 2008. But this dogma is so strong among these Charles Koch and the people that he funds that empirical evidence doesn't make any difference to them, right? So instead of looking at what happened in 2008 saying, gee, financial deregulation is a terrible idea. Look what happened to people's savings, their homes, you know, their jobs. No, they say, well, we didn't do enough. We didn't go far enough with this radical deregulation. So the world that they would have us live in would be a world in which we cannot, as majorities of citizens have, you know, for, you know, generations now, we can't organize our fellow citizens in social movements or in other ways to persuade majorities to go to government to say, okay, you know, our river in Cleveland burned down. Like, it's time to do environmental protection, the Clean Air and Water, you know, acts. Like, we wouldn't be able to do that because they want to have a government that again, only has those three functions and therefore cannot transfer tax resources from one citizen to another kind of public purpose, and that cannot engage in corporate regulation beyond the most minimal amount. So it is a stunningly radical vision, and I believe it would create an absolutely unsustainable society by every measure, you know, environmentally, obviously, economically, socially, and ultimately, in fact, psychically, too.
Right, exactly. Well, that's quite a radical vision you're talking. And just to underscore some of it, you mentioned no public schools, all be private and unregulated. So, for example, they're doing some of this now, pushing at the state and local level to get these charter schools and for-profit business run by for-profit businesses without any regulation. Like, these schools don't actually have to teach anything. There's no, like, mandate for curriculum or what the students need to know. It's like, no, they want it to be private education, private schools, business run without any regulation on what students would learn. So it's just such a setup for predators to, you know, make money but not have the children actually learn what they need to learn. And when you talk about the savings accounts, we all, you know, you say, well, what's wrong with all of us having savings account? Well, that's a great thing. But they're saying they want the individual savings account and to eliminate Social Security. So, you know,
exactly. It's not a both and. It's an either or. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And we're going to talk about that in a couple of minutes when we come back to the Chile example where they tried that, and we'll see what a complete disaster that was. But this extreme libertarian view of the world really kind of, it's just would be such a disaster to have. For example, if you say, well, they want to wipe out the Environmental Protection Agency and say, well, everybody, you're on your own. Well, I don't know about you, but I certainly can't afford to be spending the time and money to set up labs to test my food to see, you know, what kind of toxins are in it. There's certain functions that government needs to perform in order to help, you know, guard and protect the rest of us from predatory for-profit organizations. So,
And they actually believe that there's nothing that the government does that private actors couldn't do better.
Yeah,
which is great. You know, and also, I mean, I think it's not irrelevant that the Coke industry's, you know, core base is the fossil fuel industry, and that many of the other donors that they've convened in the Coke donor network are also from the fossil fuel industry. So this libertarian dogma that government can do no good does also go with their own deep investment in an industry that is destroying our planet, right? And one of the things that they are determined to prevent is government action on climate change. And governments are the only bodies that have the strength and the capacity to do this, and governments internationally working together to address climate change. And that was actually the moment when this Koch network came together in the 1990s when, you know, there were other things too that were prompts, including disappointments with the existing Republicans. But it was the moment when both parties were starting to pay attention to climate change and realize that action was needed. And so this Koch network has worked in a determined way against that, and, you know, was pushing for getting out of the Paris Climate Accords, encouraging Brexit to get Britain to, you know, to break up any international cooperation that would lead to either climate action or lifting wage standards or, you know, providing support for the care work of women and families. All of this stuff is anathema to them.
Exactly right. And for our listeners who may not have heard of Charles Koch before, he inherited Koch Industries from his father, which started in the fossil fuel industry, and it's now branched out to many others. It's got a revenue of about $115 billion a year, so it's a huge company or set of companies at this point. So the vision you laid out and the plan for of Charles Koch and his donor network there, it's a really deeply unpopular, like eliminate Social Security, eliminate Medicare, eliminate our environmental protections, eliminate worker protections, eliminate public education. It's just like, who wants that? And when voters really know what the plan is, it would go down in flames. But it's deeply unpopular. But what you talk about in your book, Democracy in Chains, is that it would be unpopular if people actually knew what the plan was. But they've been very, is the word you use, stealth, and secretive about what they're really after. And they're very strategic in terms of, you know, couching changes that they want, doing it step by step to kind of chip away. So it's not like, oh, we're going to dismantle Social Security today.
Right.
But they take step by step to kind of limit it, decrease the number of age, decrease the amount of award giving. And then the other thing is that they know, because it's so deeply unpopular, that if the candidates they back were upfront about this whole program that they want to implement, that the candidates would lose, the voters would go, we don't want that. So what they're doing is really dismantling democracy so that elected officials would really be unable to respond to the voters who say this is what we want or don't want. Can you talk a little more about the steps? What did you learn about what their plans are for dismantling democracy to push their radical right agenda?
Yeah, so I would say, I wouldn't say that quite dismantling democracy. I mean, it amounts to that in what our lived experience would be, but I think, you know, as a historian, I always try to be faithful to the sources, and in what they would say, they want to put it in chains, right? To make it so it can only do those three functions and no more. So it's probably about the same, but I'll just say that. But, what's upsetting to me as a researcher, as a historian, as a citizen, is precisely that this the long-term plan depends so much on stealth, because I also, you know, I teach the history of social movements. I research and teach the history of social movements and their impact on public policy in America. So I believe that any group that thinks, you know, it has a good idea, or any individual for that matter, has a right to argue for that idea, right? And to try to persuade people and to organize and to use the Bill of Rights and, you know, see where you get, right? And if you persuade a majority, as many good social movements have over the years, then you can get the policy, you know, the changes that you want. And then we say that's in the public interest because you persuaded the majority. What is so deeply disturbing about this Koch network cause is that they are running an endgame around the public, precisely because they know the public will reject their agenda if they understand it. So they have turned to these stealth measures. And Charles Koch was very clear about this. I quote him in the book, but he said in 1997, when he was really launching this project in earnest, he said, because we are greatly outnumbered, the failure to use our superior technology ensures failure. So he's basically saying we have to use these stealth measures in order to get this change that we want. So how does that play out practically? Well, for example, it plays out in the use of voter suppression on a scale that we have not seen in the United States since the white segregationist South crushed black voting power at the turn of the 20th century. Mass voter suppression to keep people who would disagree with this agenda away from the polls, including African-American and Latino voters, but also young voters who don't agree with this agenda at all and have become critical of the way capitalism is operating. So mass voter suppression, the most sophisticated gerrymandering redistricting that we've ever seen in this country in what was called the Project Red Map after the 2010 midterms. Elections do have consequences. And they basically engage in this incredibly radical gerrymander to make it so that the elected officials in this radicalized Republican Party could choose their voters rather than the voters choosing their elected officials. And this matters for a minority cause, because if they accurately represented the opinion of the voters, there would not be the Republican dominance that we see now. And like my own district in North Carolina was gerrymandered in this way and was described in court filings by challengers as looking like a snowball hitting a windshield and melting. Crazy the drawing of this district was. Another example is the destruction of the power of and collective voice of public employees. So, you know, think back to March of 2011 when Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin did not run at all on a campaign of saying that he was going to attack public employees and their rights to organize. But as soon as he came into office, he gloated to his team, this is our chance to change the course of history, when he took away collective bargaining rights that Wisconsin workers had enjoyed for some 50 years. And, you know, it set off that huge conflict. But again, that was a stealth thing, right? Don't tell the voters what you really want to do, what your number one goal is. Instead, feed them some pablum and then do this incredibly radical thing that pleases your donors, not the people of your state. So, you know, we could go on and talk about more of these things, but those are three good examples of the stealth, I think. And then another thing, too, that this cause depends on is spreading misinformation. So they are among the leading backers of climate science denial, right? Misleading the public about what is happening to our planet and the urgent need for action and the fact that we are the last generation that has a window to deal with this problem. And they are wasting our time by misleading the public on how urgent it is. And they are also using racism strategically, promoting a myth of widespread voter fraud in order to pass legislation to suppress voting, to curtail early voting, to keep people from the polls. In my state, they did that in some 15 different ways using this myth of voter fraud, which you can only believe since there is absolutely no empirical evidence of significant voter fraud, and all the studies have found that where it exists, it's unintentional and it's negligible and it's mostly overwhelmed electoral systems. But they have pushed this myth so that most Republican voters believe it, and they only believe it because they think some voters are illegitimate. So it plays on the racism of white voters who could not believe that President Obama was elected legitimately. Right? There must be fraud that would explain this. Is the reasoning they're promoting and capitalizing on, and also they're promoting and capitalizing on the kind of white nationalist response to immigrants and feeling like Latino voters in particular shouldn't be having a voice in our politics. So it is really such a toxic operation, and that's why I feel it's just so urgent for people to understand where this is coming from and where it's really leading to.
Right, exactly. And what you're describing, as you say so well in Democracy in Chains, that they want to not just change the rulers, but also change the rules. So they're changing the rulers by backing candidates who will support some or all of their agenda. But they're also changing the rules that make it harder and harder, as you say, put democracy in chains, suppress the vote. And one of the ones that I find deeply disturbing is this move towards executive authority, where a state legislature can move in and say, we're knocking out the mayor and the local elected city council, and we're putting this executive in charge who will have absolute authority. And that's what happened in Flint, Michigan. And it was that executive put in charge over the mayor and the elected city council. And it was that executive who shifted the water supply to the dirty water that has led to so many public health problems and health issues for the people of Flint. And that, to me, just seems so anti-democratic and anti-American. It amazes me that that's happening. People don't even know this is happening today in the United States of America, not some banana republic, but our very own country.
Right. And in fact, voters across the spectrum now will talk about Dr. King and, speak out about King's vision on his birthday and, at least pay lip service to civil rights and talk about how horrible segregation and disenfranchisement was in the South in the days of Jim Crow. And yet most people don't know that more than 50% of African-American residents of the state of Michigan now are living under a dictatorship. Right? And that is because they are places that have been devastated by job loss, and particularly the loss of the auto industry and related industries. And so their local governments were in distress and in the red. And Charles Koch's state affiliate in Michigan, the Mackinac Center, pushed for emergency manager legislation that would take away the capacity for self-government from any local community like this that was in the red. And put this dictatorial emergency manager in place who would be utterly unaccountable to the local people, and that emergency manager can do whatever he or she wants in order to end the deficit. And so that is exactly what happened to the people of Flint. They had an emergency manager who was appointed because of this system that the Koch network pushed for, and that emergency manager, to save money, changed the source of Flint's water supply from a good water supply to a terrible lead-polluted water supply that has led to, actually there was recently a report saying the report of 12 deaths was inaccurate, that it's probably more like over 100 deaths, plus a whole generation of kids who have been exposed to lead poisoning and their parents and family members who are still having to go out and get bottled water because of this dictatorial system. And there was a brilliant op-ed by a physician in Flint who's become an activist recently, and she said that basically, because she's realized that unless we save our democracy, we can't protect people from disasters like what happened to Flint. You know, that this question of retrieving our democracy and ending this kind of stealth corporate takeover of it is essential to even such elementary matters as ensuring the public health and making sure that people have decent water and, you know, not a polluted environment in their local communities.
Right, exactly. So you've given some great examples of the changing of the rules and the putting the chains on democracy. And the ultimate one, of course, that they're aiming for is to actually change our Constitution. So I want to circle back now to what you had mentioned earlier about in Chile, and we know the intellectual architect you studied, James Buchanan, showed the Pinochet regime in Chile how they could rewrite the Constitution so it ties the hands of those who want to help the majority and it will perpetually favor the very rich. Tell us a little bit about what happened with the Chile Constitution and why is it relevant to the United States?
Yeah, this story was a revelation to me and actually has been to some people I know who have worked on, you know, scholars who have worked on Chile for years, because many people, you know, who were alive and active and reading the papers and such in the 1970s know that Milton Friedman, the University of Chicago free market fundamentalist economist, went to Chile in 1975 to advise the Pinochet government on runaway inflation, but almost no one has heard of the role that James Buchanan and his Virginia School of Political Economy played in Chile, and his is actually the more lasting and more devastating impact over the long term. So he, over the course of the 1970s, had begun to make this argument that that in order to protect the economic liberty of this minority of essentially wealthy people, property holders who felt themselves threatened by the popular majority and the things people were calling for, you know, from pollution control to anti-discrimination to, you know, measures to ease the care burden on women, all those kinds of things on top of workers' rights and Social Security, they argued that property owners and corporations were unduly burdened by all of that. And so Buchanan came to say that the only thing that could solve this is, as you just said, stopping focusing on who rules, right, who the personalities or parties you elect are, and instead changing the rules. And so he shifted into what he called constitutional economics and began to kind of game out and figure out how you could draft a constitution that would, in a sense, shackle the people, right, shackle what popular majorities could get their governments to do. And so he became known for that in the 1970s through international circles of these, you know, neoliberal figures, and he was invited by the Pinochet regime to Chile in 1980 because they knew that they were going to have to go back to elected government at some point. They were under international pressure to do this, and they had an export-oriented economy, so they really needed to cultivate international favor, but they didn't want to surrender power until they could be sure that all the radical right changes they'd made under the dictatorship would be protected when they went back to representative government. So they had, for example, privatized Social Security. They had privatized education. They had done all these other things. They had, you know, done a lot of stuff to disempower labor unions, et cetera. And so they brought Buchanan in to advise on a constitution that could block all that in and could make it so even majorities wouldn't be able to reverse these policies. And he came and he advised, and the result was a document called the Constitution of Liberty, which is still in effect in Chile today. And in 2013, Michelle Bachelet, a socialist candidate whose family actually had been tortured under the dictatorship, she was elected on a huge wave of popular organizing led by young people protesting the high cost of privatized education in Chile. She was elected on this wide-ranging reform program by two-thirds of the Chilean people, but when she got into office, she realized she could not deliver on the promises she'd made to change things because of this constitution of liberty. And she actually said, Chile needs a constitution without locks and bolts. And that phrase just really stuck with me because that's exactly what Buchanan was called in to do. That's what he'd advocated, is putting locks and bolts on what the people could do. So not checks and balances. You know, I think we all agree that checks and balances are a good thing to protect the rights of, you know, minority groups who might be, you know, harassed as different minority groups in our history have been, but not checks and balances, but actual locks and bolts. And so that constitution is still in place in Chile today, and Charles Koch was so enthused by the vision of such constitutional transformation that he brought Buchanan to the Cato Institute, which relocated to D.C., Washington, D.C., just after this, and one of the first things that they made a priority was Social Security privatization, because Chile was the first country under the dictatorship to privatize Social Security, and Charles Koch wanted to make that happen in America. So that became a priority, as did this project of constitutional revolution, which Koch began funding, and one of the things he funded, interestingly, was a Federalist Society. The Federalist Society that is now vetting all the federal judicial candidates that come from the Republican Party and that is bringing us this latest nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, who you could think of as the Koch's representative on the U.S. Supreme Court if he is confirmed.
Right. Well, you've just given us kind of the case study of how you can design a constitution. I love that phrase from President Michelle Bachelet about it's a constitution with locks and bolts on it. And not only did it make it virtually impossible for her to govern on behalf of the people, even though she had been so, as you say, elected with two-thirds of the voters, you know, they, the Koch brothers and friends, want to do a similar kind of thing in the United States. And you've described some of how they do the locks and bolts on democracy with the voter suppression and this executive authority dictatorship. You've described some of the ways that's already in motion here, but they also want to change the United States Constitution. Talk a little bit about, like, what do they want to do to our Constitution,
yeah,
and how far along are they in succeeding in changing our Constitution?
Yeah, this is a really stunning thing, and it's really sad, I think, that so many, you know, in this 24/7 media environment that we're in, you know, journalists can often just respond to the latest catnip that's thrown out, you know? So
right.
Donald Trump's tweets, right, have been absorbing, I don't know, it sometimes seems like 80% of media attention, you know, for
yep.
the last few years now. But while we're all being distracted by this man I've come to think of as the distractor-in-chief, the Kochs have been moving along through the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, that they work with, that advises, you know, their allied state legislators, to systematically line up authorizations from the states they control in order to convene a constitutional convention in America. Now, just to give you, again, a sense of how radical this would be the first state-convened constitutional convention in our history since the Constitution was drafted and ratified, and it is necessarily such a radical endeavor that even conservative judges like Warren Burger and Antonin Scalia, you know, various people on the right have said this would be crazy because it would be runaway, right? But they now have lined up 28 of the 34 states needed. Under Article 5 of the Constitution, you need two-thirds of the states, so that's 34 now. So they have 28 of the 34 states needed, and here's the real kicker, is that there are six Republican controlled states that have not yet authorized a convention. And I believe that one of the reasons the Republicans have been so profligate about running up the deficit, you know, with President Trump's tax bill, after years of saying the deficit was the worst possible thing, I believe that they're being so cavalier about that because then they will use this enormous deficit they've created to say, this is why we must have a constitutional convention, because the first item of business of that constitutional convention would be a balanced budget amendment. This is something the right has tried and failed for decades to get from the normal political process, because it's something that polls well until people understand that what it really aims to do is undermine ongoing programs like Social Security and Medicare and various, you know, all the protections of the environment and so forth that we depend on. So they actually have 10 liberty amendments, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners will think I'm crazy and I'm making this up, so they can just Google the liberty amendments. There's a book by a Koch-funded legal scholar named Mark Levin, who's also a right-wing, you know, one of these hateful right-wing radio figures, but it's called The Liberty Amendments, and it's sold a ton of copies on the right, and there's even just a wiki page that lists them. But so they include a balanced budget amendment, they include putting voter ID, mandatory voter ID, into the Constitution, and again, just to give you a sense of how radically reactionary this is, they actually want to revoke a 100-year-old constitutional amendment, the 17th Amendment, that was brought in the progressive era to fight corporate power by letting the people directly elect our U.S. senators. They want to make it so that state legislatures choose U.S. senators again. And that is very shrewd, because the branch of government that corporations most easily control is state government, because it's the branch of government that most people pay the least attention to. So, you know, then there are all these other amendments that they have in there. But that, I think, gives you a sense of the sweep of it, that this is a radical power play to fundamentally change the governing rules of our society in order to completely rewrite the social contract in a way that would please right-wing billionaires and millionaires like the Kochs, and would leave the rest of us absolutely gobsmacked. But by the time it happened, we would be unable to change it, because they would have had this constitutional convention, and if they get Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court, that's checkmate, right? Because that right-wing Federalist Society-based majority on the Supreme Court could say, oh, this was a perfectly legitimate constitutional convention. These are the rules we have to abide by now.
That really is stunning, and I so appreciate you letting us know about it. I mean, the image that comes to me, Nancy, with your great book and what you're exposing here, is you're like the modern-day Paula Revere, sounding the alarm.
I love that.
Let us know what the plans are by Charles Koch and the Koch Donor Network, what they really have in store for us. And you're right, we're all so distracted by the entertainment of the occupant of the White House that we're, you know, a lot of this is happening without us really paying any attention to it. And to the extent there is attention, people going, oh, well, this tax bill that got passed in December by the Republicans with not a single Democratic vote, the tax scam bill that's going to cost at least $1.5 trillion, probably $2 trillion, which is a big bonanza for the very wealthy and big business whose tax cuts are permanent, with some breadcrumbs thrown to the middle class, which are going to expire in a couple of years anyway.
Yeah. So basically a bribe. We should think about it as a bribe.
Yeah, exactly. You know, to get it through. But some people have pointed that out and said, well, now that the Republicans have been so profligate in raiding the public treasury to give massive tax breaks to the already wealthy and to the big businesses, they're going to use that as the opportunity or occasion to eliminate Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, and which, as you pointed out, it was one of the top two priorities there for Charles Koch, is, you know, privatizing Social Security, kind of getting rid of that public function. But you're saying that's also the opportunity that they've made, or going to use that occasion as an opportunity for his second priority, which is the constitutional revolution.
Yep.
And rewriting the Constitution. So, and the fact that the Republicans already control 28 of the 34 states they need, and there's 6 more Republican states that haven't voted on this yet, I think, you know, it may just be a matter of strategic timing. When, you know, when they want to do it, they will. So
yeah.
This is deeply concerning, and we have just about 10 minutes left on the show, and before we have people be utterly in despair, this is why I say to people, you got to read Democracy in Chains to really know what you're up against. And people say, well, I'm already depressed. I don't want to hear more that's going to make me more depressed. But I actually think it's important to know, because when you see it, then it makes so much sense of what is going on here.
Yeah.
It's a coherent strategy that we're up against. So I want to focus now on kind of what do we do about it. And you've been out there speaking on it. You're clearly a patriot. What do you know better than almost anybody, probably than they do themselves, what the strategy is. What should our strategy be? And I know you're an historian and a professor, so it's not your job to kind of lead the charge, but you have a unique view and great depth of knowledge about what we're facing here. What do you recommend we do strategically to defend our democracy?
Yeah, well, thank you for that, and thank you also for noting that I am a historian, so, you know, I have some ideas, but also, my contribution is helping us understand how we got to this point, but I am also, I've been traveling around the country, I'm talking to a lot of groups in the trenches, you know, people from across every sector of the progressive movement, so I'm also learning a lot from others in this process that I can share. And one thing I will say, because I'm sure a lot of people will be rightly alarmed at this constitutional revolution prospect, right, and the Constitutional Convention and also the Kavanaugh nomination. So I would let people know that Common Cause has probably been the best group in tracking this Constitutional Convention effort, and they actually did get a number of states to withdraw, to rescind their authorizations. Unfortunately, there are no more that can be rescinded at this point, they believe, but they are tracking it. So if people are interested in that, they should go and look at the Common Cause website. But I would say also, because, you know, in addition to writing this book, I'm a historian, I think I mentioned that, of social movements and their impact on public policy. And so it may surprise listeners at this point in the conversation to hear this, but I am actually hopeful, guardedly hope, not optimistic, because that would be silly and naive, but I am guardedly hopeful that if enough people are alerted and enough people become active in dealing with this, this could actually be a moment of historic transformation for the better in our country. And as a historian, I look at this moment as being equivalent to the 1860s, when the earlier defenders of this extreme economic liberty, the Southern slaveholders with their secession project, wanted to defeat democracy in the name of the liberty for property owners. And we had a civil war and Reconstruction, which kind of recreated democracy in our country and made it newly inclusive, at least of all men for the first time. So that is a moment when the people rallied and set back a threat like this. In the 1930s and the Great Depression, the ancestors of Charles Koch's project, the American Liberty League, the corporate right-wing corporate leaders of the time, were determined that there be no government action to help the people through the worst economic catastrophe in history. One of them, Albert Sloan of General Motors, actually said that the sit-down strikers at GM should have been shot, right? They shouldn't have been allowed to organize unions with government backing. They should have been shot, and that there should be no government provision for the people's needs in the way of Social Security and things like that. So again, there was a mass mobilization, a huge labor movement, a huge mobilization of older Americans for what became Social Security. People saw the threat from this arch economic liberty minority. They rallied, and they used democracy in order to renew and expand democracy. I believe we're in a similar moment now. It is not as dramatic. Of course, we're not in a war. We're not facing a catastrophic depression. But we are facing a small group of corporate leaders, and I do believe that is what Charles Koch represents. I believe they're the extreme right. They are not all corporations. They are not all people of wealth, but who are determined, who have taken it upon themselves to transform our society in a way that pleases them, in the belief, and this is the language Buchanan used, that the rest of us are parasites. I mean, it's really, really chilling language, but that's how they think. And they're going to think they're going to stop that. So what I'm seeing as I've been traveling around the country is, and also I think Donald Trump's election, you know, is a lot, like unintended consequences, has alerted people, has woken up people who are not paying attention, has led to a huge surge of activism, particularly but not only among women, you know, at the local and state level, but I'm seeing people all around the country who are really getting that we are at an all-hands-on-deck moment for the defense of our democracy and of all the things that we hold dear and the kind of society they that we want for our children and our grandchildren. And, you know, not enough numbers yet, but it is happening. People are alerting one another. They're you know, educating their own networks and their communities, and they're getting into action in the ways that make sense for who they are, for what their passions are, what their skills are, what the opportunities for activism are where they live. But they're reaching out and making that happen. So that is my hope, that by playing, I love what you call it, the Paula Revere role, but that I can, in a sense, you know, help to amplify all the good people who are out there already organizing, already trying to take back and reinvigorate democracy and deal with all the pent-up issues that we have, and take this moment of the most extreme grave threat and turn it into instead an opportunity to renew our democracy in the ways that we've needed for decades now, but we have been unable to do because of things like the power of money in politics, you know, all the things that deter participation. So it is a frightening moment. It is an absolutely audacious, integrated, long game strategic plan on the right. But on the other hand, I take confidence and courage and hope from the fact that this Koch network is doing what it's doing because they understand that they only represent a tiny minority, and they are afraid that the rest of us will understand what it is they want and how they're trying to do it, and that we will stop them. And so my hope is that we do that, that we are able to stop them.
Fantastic. Well, we'll certainly do everything that we can. And I would encourage our listeners to read your book, Democracy in Chains, because we're going to have the best chance of defeating this extremist vision and movement or a small group with our own social movement. But the more informed we are, the more effective we'll be. So I thank you so very much for your incredible work. And do you have any final comment on what you'd like to say to our listeners or how they can stay in touch with you or learn more about what you're doing?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, first of all, I also want to thank you for your work and for this incredibly important show that you do that is such a service to your listeners in alerting them to things that are happening and informing them. I am traveling around the country to various places and speaking to audiences, and I suppose that if people wanted to get on my, I do now have a mailing list. I haven't activated it yet, but we're building it. So they could write to me and I could get their name added to the mailing list so that they could, you know, be informed of, you know, places where I'd be speaking, but also I want to use the mailing list to alert people to, for example, you know, the work that Common Cause is doing on that constitutional convention, or that other grassroots or organizations are, you know, doing in the states controlled by this radicalized, transformed Republican Party that's kind of become a tool of the donors network now. And I want to, you know, kind of help to amplify, say, that the teachers organizing in the red states like my own North Carolina and also West Virginia, Arizona, Oklahoma, et cetera. So I'll use that mailing list to try to circulate information like that to try to plug people into, endeavors that they can get involved with that are challenging this. But I think also people can look around their own communities and think about, you know, again, where their passions are, because there's no single one magic way to approach this. It's going to take effort on a whole variety of fronts. And I think each one of us, if we think about, you know, who is in our personal networks, what organizations we belong to, what passions and talents we have, we can find ways to plug in and set things right.
Thank you, Nancy McLean. Thank you so much for being with us today and for all your vital work for democracy.
Thank you so much, Eleanor. It's a pleasure talking with you.